Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Kathy Bostrom from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah Daily. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. How to Talk About Screens and Mental Health in a Way Kids Hear, by Charlie Burlock. In 2024, Jonathan Haidt published his bestseller, The Anxious Generation, and spoke with Oprah for The Life You Want, Teen Mental Health, about the mounting global teen mental health crisis, and the great rewriting of childhood from play-based to phone-based, fueled by smartphones and social media. Since then, his message about how technology affects kids' well-being, which Oprah has called one of the most pressing issues of our time, has reached millions. In his two appearances on the Oprah podcast, he spoke to parents who had managed to raise well-adjusted, highly social children without smartphones, and to those dealing with the cognitive and emotional consequences of their teens' dependence on highly addictive technology. Haidt has remained steadfast in his advice that parents should not let their kids get a smartphone until at least age 14, and should keep them off social media until at least 16, ideas that are now codified in law in Australia, with its recent age restrictions on sites like TikTok, X, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat, and Threads. Even with his research gaining real traction, Haidt's conversations keep circling back to one familiar impasse. Parents want to delay smartphone use. Kids insist that everyone else has one. And often, peer pressure wins out. Rather than raining down on children from above, Haidt realized he needed to meet young people on their level and tell them a story that would empower them to choose a real childhood over a virtual one, on their own terms. He teamed up with Catherine Price, the author of How to Break Up with Your Phone, who had joined Oprah for a separate The Life You Want class on cultivating more joy, to write The Amazing Generation, an illustrated call to action aimed at 9 to 12-year-olds, but accessible to pretty much anyone who wants to cut down on their screen time. Though neither had previously written a children's book, both had lived experience as parents and research expertise on effective persuasion strategies that made them uniquely well-suited for the job. To celebrate the publication of The Amazing Generation, our editor-at-large, Gail King, is hosting a special event with both authors, as well as special guests, including comedian Amy Schumer. Ahead of that conversation, Haidt and Price shared some research-backed, parent-approved strategies they picked up while writing the book that can help any parent navigate the phone conversation with clear boundaries, fewer power struggles, and a plan you can actually stick to. Intervene early. While so-called screenagers are often the poster children for tech debates, Price and Haidt were intentional in their decision to write The Amazing Generation for kids who hadn't yet hit adolescence. The most fateful decision is when the kid gets a phone, Haidt explains. By age 11 or 12, the majority of kids already have a smartphone, and for a large percentage, it's going to move to the center of their lives and stay there forever. Practically, it's much easier to prevent the phone from becoming a child's gravitational center than to wrestle it away once it's already embedded in their routine. Scientifically, most of the cognitive damage from smartphone and social media use occurs during early childhood and puberty, so delaying access helps future-proof the brain by protecting the critical development of attention, emotional regulation, and social processing. The authors conducted focus groups and determined that kids ages 9 to 12 would be most receptive to the book's message, a finding that Price saw in action when she presented the ideas to fourth and fifth graders at her daughter's school. She didn't get a single eye roll, and the students went over the allotted time asking questions, sharing their own stories, and talking about which flip phones they wanted to get in place of an iPhone. If kids hate one thing, it's being taken advantage of. They get very indignant, Price explains, noting how enraged the students became when she explained how tech companies profit off shrinking their years of play and exploration to the dimensions of a touchscreen. You only get one childhood, and for most kids, Meta owns it, Haight adds. Nail the tone. The way to get kids' buy-in is not to lecture at them, Price says. Any parent who's had a fight with their kid about screen time knows that that is not the winning approach. Before becoming a science journalist, Price had taught and tutored kids in middle school through high school, and says she still has the sense of humor of a middle school boy. Bringing humor and connection into this serious discussion isn't just a garnish, it's a persuasive strategy. Through teaching and through the research she did for The Power of Fun, her 2021 book on replacing the artificial rewards of technology with real-world happiness, she understands that laughter and fun are critical to learning. While there is no shortage of alarming research on the impact of tech on developing brains, Haight knows from his research on morality that you don't persuade people by giving them reasons and evidence. You persuade them by speaking to the heart and giving them an intuitive sense of what you're saying and then backing it up with evidence. In practice, that can mean starting with a gut-level hook. I've had nights where I'm tired and still can't stop scrolling. Have you? Before presenting your evidence. If you don't have that connection in the first place, all the evidence in the world isn't going to change their minds. The Amazing Generation is designed to foster connection between parents and children with prompts like the one encouraging kids to ask the adults in their lives over a certain age to imitate the sound of a dial-up modem and brace themselves. Price has already heard accounts from friends about the hilarity that ensues. I think the playful attitude that we have in the book really equalizes the playing field between adults and kids and encourages these conversations as equals rather than this top-down, lecturing, confrontational approach, she says. Even when talking about serious topics, or especially when talking about serious topics, the more you can laugh together and the more you have fun together, the more open people are to hearing the message. Be the guinea pig. In The Anxious Generation, Haight deliberately chose not to ask parents to interrogate their own tech habits, in part to keep the focus on kids and to not criticize parents and parenting, but also because, as a social psychologist, he understands that middle schoolers are much more influenced by their peers' behavior than by adults. Of course they're going to say, "But Mom, you're always on your phone," he acknowledges. But that's because they're really good lawyers, attuned to the ways that their parents' hypocrisy might undermine the boundaries they're trying to set, not because they plan to mimic Mom's phone-free lifestyle if only she adopts it first. Still, there is a power in parents being open about their own struggles with technology and in asking for advice from their own children. Price suggests that a great way to initiate a conversation around screen time that doesn't feel adversarial is to say, "I'm actually interested in changing some of my own habits, too. Is there anything you want to try together?" Approached this way, discussions about devices and boundaries shift from parents imposing something to families building something together, giving kids a sense of agency while easing parents out of the role of constant enforcer. I actually think it really can be a good way to help your kids in kind of an indirect way, Price adds, because they like feeling like they've got some kind of input on their parents' behaviors. This isn't a strategic bluff to get kids on board. It's an honest admission that the device struggle isn't just a teen problem. Price has heard from kids for years about how ignored and hurt they feel when their parents are on their phones while they're together. For all of us, it's gotten out of control, she says, and our kids could help us. While dialing back screen time can strengthen your relationship with your kids and make healthier tech norms feel possible, it's not just good parenting. Haight and Price are focused on children because screens are threatening to rob them of things they can't get back, childhood itself, and developmental foundations that shape mental health for years to come. But the losses don't end with childhood, and kids aren't the only ones who deserve to be indignant about the real-world experiences we are missing out on in our increasingly digitized existence. As Price points out, we adults deserve to have good lives too. And that's How to Talk About Screens and Mental Health in a Way Kids Hear by Charlie Burlock. Up next, death anniversaries are a heartbreak no one talks about. This ritual gets me through. A psychiatrist shares how embracing a Korean tradition helped her grieve her father's death after years of avoiding the pain, by Suzanne Song, MD, PhD. On March 6, 2018, I was having a lot of trouble focusing on work, and I wasn't sure why. This wasn't an altogether rare occurrence, as I was working full-time and parenting two kids under the age of two. This particular inability to focus, though, felt different. It was hard to read, and I was distracted with my patients. Instead of proper meals, I relied on cereal. I had had vivid dreams the previous night that I could not remember, and I was exhausted. I was able to accomplish the bare minimum needed for the day, but I did so with an undercurrent of terror and listlessness. That evening, as I spooned up some more cereal, it occurred to me that the difficulty focusing, poor sleep, and buzzing unease were actually the norm for this day. It was the anniversary of my father's death. One would think that after 24 years, I'd be better prepared to manage the grief. Every year on this day, guilt creeps in that I'm not doing more to honor his life. Yet what surprises me is the anxiety I feel about my own mortality. My father's death anniversary always hits me with instability, as it calls me to attend to feelings about death that aren't usually on my agenda. For years, I tried to avoid reminders of his death. If I avoided thinking about my father, I rationalized, my yearning and sadness would eventually dissolve. I could continue to go about my days fully in charge of when, where, and with whom I shared my memories of him. This worked, more or less, until my second child was born. At this point, my erratic grief was coupled with deep sadness and a shaking sense of fear at the thought of dying in my 40s like my father and missing out on seeing my children grow. With a newborn and a toddler to care for, I searched for a path to guide me through this anniversary day. My grieving felt unfinished at best and ignored at worst. Feeling lost, I turned to my Korean heritage for inspiration. During summer visits to my grandparents' home in Seoul, I remember watching my aunts bumping into each other in a crowded kitchen as they prepared soup and fish while my grandfather burned incense in a Jessa ceremony that honored deceased family members as far back as five generations. Honoring the dead, especially one's ancestors, is an important part of Korean culture, tied to Confucius's teachings of piety and love for one's family. Many Koreans believe that after someone dies, the spirit doesn't immediately leave Earth, but stays with surviving family members for multiple generations. The Jaesuk tradition celebrates and honors deceased family members to show respect, strengthen the bond between the living family and the deceased, and encourage the deceased spirit to watch over living descendants. Now, every March 6th, I engage in my own personal Jaesa. I prepare an altar, a black mother-of-pearl table adorned with stacked oranges and apples, symbolizing good health for loved ones, layered rice cakes for celebration, and a bowl of dumpling soup for long life. I give 10 ceremonial bows in front of a photo of my father to show respect and love. Then, while sipping a cup of his favorite black Lipton tea, I reminisce about going hiking with him and watching him groom our dog, and I think about the ways in which I'm grateful for his presence in my life. Engaging in this ritual every year doesn't prevent the ache of guilt I feel around his anniversary, but it does allow me to feel more in control and to focus my emotions. My jitteriness eases and guilt subsides. I find comfort in the process. Physical stiffness and aches abate as I heal the internal knots on his death anniversary. A fresh sense of agency circulates through me as I intentionally embrace his death as well as his life. I feel deeply connected to him while also imagining a satisfying future without him. The Jesa ritual is more than a memorial ceremony. It is a scaffold for my pain and connects me to ancestors and culture past and present, all of which increases my capacity to embrace the intensely emotional and disruptive grieving that comes with memories of how my father lived and died. Rituals are reflections of the values, fears, and hopes that shape individuals and societies. In many cases, the power of ritual lies not in what is said, but in what is felt. Not all emotions and experience need to be processed verbally. Sometimes words just get in the way. Leaning on rituals through the processes of separation, liminality, and reintegration helps us find motivation amid the turmoil, create movement and stuckness, and turn doubts into strength. This is excerpted from Why We Suffer and How We Heal by Suzanne Song, MD, PhD. And that was Death Anniversaries Are a Heartbreak No One Talks About. This Ritual Gets Me Through by Suzanne Song. Up next, this shockingly simple mental exercise is the secret to healthy change. The ability to feel into the future is unique to humans. Here's What It Means and Why It Works by Brad Stuhlberg. Say you have a few hours on a Saturday afternoon. You can either focus on something that matters to you, connecting with your partner, playing with your child, creating stained glass, or going to the gym, or you can mindlessly scroll social media, check and recheck your email, and tap away at Candy Crush. In the short term, getting lost in your phone might feel good. It requires little to no effort, and it satisfies your innate drives for excitement and novelty. In the exhaustion and chaos of the world, sometimes it's just plain old comforting to turn off your brain and zone out. In the long term, however, zoning out on your phone, especially if it becomes a repeated habit, is likely unconducive to your values and goals. At the end of the day, you probably won't feel great. You'll know that you wasted an opportunity to do something meaningful. Many people even report a psychological hangover following these episodes. It's a classic case of acute feelings being in conflict with their chronic consequences. A best practice is to think about what getting sucked into your phone would feel like after the fact. The answer, for most of us, is lousy. Getting in touch with that future feeling helps you make the right decision in the present moment. Our ability to think and therefore feel our way into the future is a big part of what separates us from other species. Could you imagine what would happen if each of us had to learn from experience what happens when you jump off a cliff or pick up a viper? Writes the neuroscientist Mark Solms in his book, The Hidden Spring, A Journey to the Source of Consciousness. Thinking allows us to simulate how an experience might feel. In doing so, we can appreciate its potential benefits and harms without putting ourselves at risk. Many of us, perhaps without even fully recognizing it, are craving the real, deeply felt experience of excellence. But with countless superficial substitutes on offer, not to mention ever-shifting goalposts for so-called success and happiness, we all too easily find ourselves overwhelmed and fatigued while bored, dull, and wanting for something more. Much of modern life is characterized by a restless exhaustion, and it manifests in surprising ways. In 2023, the social scientist Michael Bang Peterson and his colleagues coined a concept to describe intensifying political and social unrest, along with the proliferation of ever more wild conspiracy theories. They called it the need for chaos. It explains how we desperately want to feel alive and excited. But without more enriching options, that desperation reveals itself in people actively supporting, and in some cases directly initiating, chaos, be it by electing polarizing political leaders, spreading ridiculous conspiracies, engaging in destructive behaviors, cheering on damage to public spaces, or supporting the destruction of civil institutions, norms, and decency. A 2024 meta-analysis in the journal Nature Communications found the factor showing the strongest association with conspiracy beliefs to be social alienation. Additional research shows that boredom is also a driving force. If people are numbed out by a lack of genuine connection, excitement, and dynamism, even disorder and mayhem start to seem enticing. They become so starved of authentic emotional resonance that they'll accept just about anything that makes them feel. It explains why even the best of us get caught up in doom scrolling, gossip, political outrage, and checking and rechecking websites and news alerts on our phone. We crowd out any stillness and space for our minds. We do anything to fill the void, even if the result is a groggy, worn-out feeling. But this is absurd, and it doesn't have to be this way. There are deeper, more fulfilling, and more productive avenues to feeling alive and reconnecting with ourselves. These deeper and more fulfilling avenues may not be the default, but that doesn't mean we can't choose them. It's not just doom scrolling and chaos. There are many situations in which our short-term feelings, whether temptation, fear, or excitement, conflict with our values and goals long-term. It's why people who struggle with binge eating disorders are taught to pause and think about how they'll feel when not gorging on chocolate now, but rather when they wake up the next morning. If they can learn to tap into this future feeling, it subjugates their drive to overeat. It's good counsel for any temptation, from having an extra drink to saying something to a colleague you might regret. If you can think ahead, which in turn enables you to feel ahead, you give yourself a better chance of making the right decision in the moment. We are often faced with the comfort, pleasure, or ease of short-term decisions that contradict our values and long-term goals. Anyone who has been tempted by staying in a warm and cozy bed instead of going for that brisk morning run knows this firsthand. We live in a world that encourages superficial seeking, yet it is unwavering commitment, including enduring some downright drudgery, that gives rise to genuine excellence. The key is to think beyond your immediate feelings and check them against your desires for the future. If we can connect these imagined futures to our values and goals, we give ourselves the best chance to stay on the path. And that was This Shockingly Simple Mental Exercise is the Secret to Healthy Change by Brad Stuhlberg. And next, yes, daylight saving time can feel even worse during menopause. Here's how to deal. You're not imagining it. Try these tricks to make springing forward less painful. By Sophia Lodato. Say goodbye for now to seasonal affective disorder. On Sunday, March 8th, millions of Americans set their clocks an hour ahead for daylight saving time. But as much as we might love the idea of springing forward into longer, brighter days, our natural circadian rhythms prefer otherwise, particularly if you're in perimenopause or menopause. Our circadian clock, an area of your brain that sets the timing of your sleep-wake cycle and other functions, regulates when hormones like cortisol, melatonin, and insulin are released throughout the day. Deanna Minich, PhD, CNS, a functional medicine expert and nutritional scientist, calls the first two hormones on that list our circadian bookends. When you wake up, your cortisol levels rise in response to light to help you feel alert. And 1 to 3 hours before bedtime, your body starts to release melatonin to lull you to sleep. Our bodies crave consistency. That's why one of the most common tips for sleeping well is going to bed and waking up at the same time every day. But when DST shifts the clock and your body believes it's just 6 a.m. when your alarm wakes you up at 7 a.m., particularly since it's now dark outside, your natural cortisol response struggles to kick in accordingly. Cue grogginess and overall misery. even though losing 1 hour seems insignificant, it actually has a lot of ripple effects with your hormonal biology, says Minich. Everyone is affected to some degree by DST, to the point where medical experts say the biennial time jump is unhealthy. But it can hit even harder for women in perimenopause, when hormones are already in flux. Our circadian signals start to become less strong, and our endocrine system overall is declining, explains Minich, which makes our bodies more sensitive to disruptions like sleep loss. And most menopausal women are already facing issues with mood and sleep, issues that likely will be exacerbated by the DST shift while your body adjusts to the new normal. Unfortunately, DST isn't going anywhere without an act of Congress. But you can mitigate the pain. For one, it's really important to start to shift one's sleep before DST happens, says Minich. Around 3 days beforehand, start going to bed about 15 minutes earlier each night. She says you can use melatonin supplements to help ease the transition, as you would to stave off jet lag. And limit your caffeine and alcohol intake in the days leading up to DST, as both can be very disruptive to our systems, says Minich. In the week after the time change, do your best to keep consistent bedtimes and head outside daily in the morning to help your body reset its internal clock, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends. Yes, we may be forced to spring forward, but at least we'll have some more sunlight each day to get us through. And that was, yes, daylight saving time can feel even worse during menopause. Here's How to Deal, by Sophia Lodato. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kathy Bostrom, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Civilization.